Hello, this is Debbie again. This is part two, Herald Review, Decatur for Wednesday, September 23rd, 2015, beginning with the death notices, starting with Mowikwa, Stephen L. Bickle. Steve Bickle, 72, of Mowikwa, died September 18th, 2015, in his home. Graveside services will be at 12:30 p.m. Saturday, September 26, 2015, in Jacob's Cemetery, Mowikwa. Visitation will be from 10 to 12 prior to service time in Site's Funeral Home, Mowikwa. Memorials may be made to the Alzheimer's Association or Cancer Care. Decatur. Richard David Camfield, 49, in Decatur, Illinois, passed away at 10:45 a.m. September 21st, 2015 at St. Mary's Hospital, Decatur, Illinois. Funeral services will be at 10 a.m. Friday, September 25th, 2015 at the Argenta United Methodist Church with Pastor Lyle Artman officiating. Burial will follow in the Friends Creek Cemetery, Argenta. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 Thursday, September 24th, at the church. Memorials may be directed to an education fund for his children. Calvert Funeral Home Argenta is in charge of arrangements. Decatur, Lassam Damer Curry, Jr. Lassam Damer Curry, Jr., infant son of Shalkitha Reed and Lassam Curry, Sr., was placed in the loving arms of Jesus on Saturday, September 19, 2015, in St. John's Hospital, Springfield. Funeral services for Lassam will be 10 a.m. Friday, September 25th, in Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Burial will be in Garden of Angels, Graceland Cemetery, and conclude with the flight home ceremony. Decatur, Rudolph Lettrick, Jr. Rudolph Lettrick, Jr., 64, a Decatur, passed away Saturday, September 19, 2015, at St. Mary's Hospital in Decatur. Services to celebrate Rudolph's life will be at 10 a.m. Thursday, September 24th, at St. Paul Lutheran Church, 1 Back Rack Court, Decatur, with Pastor Frey Offerman officiating. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 tonight, Wednesday, September 23rd, at Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home, and for 1 hour prior to the services at the church. Interment will be at Graceland Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to the wishes of the family in care of Ann Lettrick. Macon, Mildred Collier. Mildred Mickey Collier, 85, of Macon, Illinois, passed away at 5:05 a.m. on Thursday, September 17, 2015, in her residence. A memorial service to celebrate Mickey's life will be held at 3 p.m. on Sunday, September 27th, at Dawson and Wyckoff Funeral Home, Macon. The family will receive friends for a time of visitation from 1 p.m. until service time on Sunday. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be directed to a food bank of your choice or the American Diabetes Association. And that is the end of the listed obituaries in today's paper for Wednesday, September 23rd. We are now going to the front page of the other Decatur paper. Editor and publisher for the Decatur Tribune, Paul Osborne, his city beat. Aldi request to rezone southeast corner of Ash Avenue and US 51 will be considered October 19th. The Aldi request to rezone the parcels of land at the southeast corner of Ash Avenue and US 51 so they can move forward with the proposed new Aldi grocery store is currently scheduled to be considered at the October 19th Decatur City Council meeting. Meeting will be held at 5:30 p.m. at the Decatur Civic Center. The Decatur Plan Commission gave its approval for the rezoning recently, and approval by the City Council is the final step in clearing the hurdles to move ahead with the project. There has been a lot of negative response from neighbors of the area who have strong feelings against the project at that location due to the increase in traffic congestion. They have appeared before the Plan Commission and City Council to urge a no vote on the rezoning, and they are sure to be present at the meeting to again voice their concerns before the council takes the final vote. It will probably be standing room only in the City Council chamber that night. Next thing he's writing on with City Council. City Council has approved Christopher S. Funk to fill the seat left vacant when Julie Moore Wolf was appointed mayor last month following the sudden death of Mayor Mike McElroy. The vote, along with the swearing-in of Funk, took place on Monday evening's City Council meeting. Funk, 35, is currently Senior Vice President and Chief Credit Officer at Hickory Point Bank and Trust and was chosen by the council from 20 applicants for the position. He was one of the four finalists who were interviewed last week. The vote of the council for Funk was not unanimous. City Council member Dr. Dana Ray didn't waver in her support of G.E. Livingston to fill the position, contending he was the best qualified. Livingston, who finished second to Mike McElroy in this year's mayoral election, was also one of the four finalists for the position. Councilman Bill Faber did not vote for Funk because he didn't like the process used to reach that decision. He also missed the final closed session where the finalists were interviewed. Although several council replacements have been approved during the past 6 or 7 years using the same process, I don't remember there ever being such, if any, public division on the council over the selections made. Best wishes to Funk and the council as they face some tough votes in the near future. Next thing in the column is use the bike path. In addition to sidewalks on West Main Street, there is also a wide concrete bike path where bicyclists and people walking are separated. That keeps bicyclists from running into those who are out for a walk since they're on separate sidewalks. The bike path was designed to keep bicyclists from riding in the street and possibly being hit by the car. But, well, guess what? The bicyclists are not riding on the sidewalk anymore since the bike path was built, but I've seen many of them riding in the street. Why some bicyclists would choose the street instead of a smooth, safe path to ride defies explanation. Next topic, neighborhood walk. The City of Decatur will hold a neighborhood walk on Thursday, September 24th in the Fairlawn neighborhood beginning at 5:30 p.m. The walk will begin in the parking lot of MacArthur High School on Taylor Road. The purpose of the walks is to encourage a better connection between residents and the city, gain input from residents, and to provide and encourage direct interaction. For the past 3 years, the Decatur City Council and city staff have led a series of walks through various neighborhoods in an effort to learn firsthand the needs of individual neighborhoods, identify success stories, and to encourage dialogue with residents. The event will begin with city staff leading a discussion about neighborhood and city successes and concerns, available resources, and other requests that have come up as part of the past walks. A brief walk will follow the session. Residents are encouraged to meet at the starting point to participate if the walking route does not include their residents. All walks are scheduled to take place during the week of the City Council meeting. This is the third walk to be held this season. The neighborhood walks represent one of a number of city initiatives designed to reinvigorate city neighborhoods. End of his column. Paul Osborne. A few event and meetings to list here. HSHS St. Mary's Hospital Fall Retreat Day, Making Right Choices, October 3rd. Every second of every minute of every hour of every day, we constantly have to make choices. This free retreat day is to encourage us to make decisions and choices that are life-giving and positively impact our spiritual growth. The retreat day will be held at Chiara Center on Laverna Road in Springfield on Saturday, October 3rd from 9 to 4. It will be led by Sister Anna Ferry, a hospital sister of the Third Order of St. Francis. She has a master's degree in theology and a certificate in spiritual direction. Sister Anna has directed retreats in Africa, Canada, and the United States. Registration is required by today, Wednesday, September 23rd. If you're interested, contact Anita Ricker, probably right away, at 217-464-1074. They might still have space. Then next event here listed, Walk to End Alzheimer's at Forsyth Village Park, also October 3rd. Alzheimer's Association's Walk to End Alzheimer's, sponsored by Imboden Creek Health Services and Christian Homes Incorporated will be held Saturday, October 3rd at Forsyth Village Park, located at 700 West Weaver Road in Forsyth. Registration will begin at 8:30 a.m., opening ceremony at 9:30 a.m., and the walk is at 10 a.m. Start or join a team by calling 726-5184 or visiting alz.org/walk. Walk to End Alzheimer's participants will learn about Alzheimer's disease, advocacy opportunities, clinical studies, enrollment, and support programs and services. Participants will also honor those affected by Alzheimer's disease with the Promise Garden ceremony. And lastly, Decatur Trail Riders will have a two-day horse show September 26th and 27th. Decatur Trail Riders will have a two-day horse show. This will be an exhibition on Saturday, September 26th at 3 p.m. and an NBHA-approved show at 5 p.m. A For Pleasure show will be held Sunday, September 27th at 9 a.m. End of the events for the Chicago Tribune listing. And that is the end of the articles from the Decatur Tribune. Checking back with the Herald Review under late-breaking news, 3 minutes ago, they posted this article. It's out of Chicago. An effort to identify the remains of young men murdered by serial killer John Wayne Gacy in the 70s has led to a break in an unrelated case of a previously unidentified teenager found shot to death in San Francisco 36 years ago. The Cook County Sheriff's Office said tests have revealed a genetic association between the teenager and the DNA of a woman whose half-brother, Andre Droth, went missing decades ago. The sheriff asked relatives of missing teens to submit DNA to determine if it had matched unidentified Gacy victims, and the woman submitted hers in 2011. The sheriff's office submitted the DNA to a federal database. The match was discovered after San Francisco authorities submitted DNA of the teen to the database last year. Also, at the Herald and Review website, they have an AP listing of the 10 things to know for today. Your daily look at late-breaking news, upcoming events, and stories that will be talked about today. 1. Pope of the Poor arrives in U.S. Francis and Obama will meet in the Oval Office to advance causes dear to them both, watched by a nation that can't get enough of the humble man and also unsettling conservatives in American Catholicism. 2. Refugee crisis amplifies EU rifts. European Union leaders are divided along an east-west fault line over whether their countries should be required to accept asylum seekers, mostly Muslim, fleeing the Middle East. 3. Economy on Chinese president's agenda in U.S. When Xi Jinping addresses top American leaders, business leaders today, they may be most interested in what he says about progress toward a treaty for broader investment. 4. China's slowdown fuels unease abroad, but even a weaker Chinese economy is on track to turn in some of the world's strongest growth this year. 5. Yankee Hall of Fame catcher Yogi Berra dies at 90. He is renowned as much for his dizzying malapropisms as his record 10 World Series championships with the New York Yankees. 6. Were experts locals scrambling to document heritage? In Syria, the rush is on to create creative ways to protect its cultural legacy in the face of eradication at the hands of the Islamic State group. 7. Who appears on Stephen Colbert's show? The CBS host showers thanks on Donald Trump, reducing the usually domineering GOP frontrunner to a straight man status. 8. Volkswagen shares slide again on scandal. VW said 11 million of its diesel vehicles worldwide contain software that evade emissions controls. 9. Judge frees Happy Birthday song from copyright status. Claims Happy Birthday is finally free after 80 years, says Randall Newman, one of the plaintiff's attorneys. And finally, number 10. What's hot for Halloween? Expect to see Michelangelo, Donatello, Leonardo, and Raphael again this year. The Turtles. Ninja Turtles. End of that list. Again, from the Decatur Review website, under Weird News, Pennsylvania reporter working story finds missing boys. A newspaper reporter, this is in State College, found two missing boys who it turns out were just skipping school after he was sent to cover their disappearance in central Pennsylvania. Center Daily Times reporter Sean Onorelli says the boys aged 7 and 9 were supposed to board a bus to their charter school Tuesday but didn't. State College police posted their picture on Twitter about an hour later and Onorelli began poking around in some bushes near a playground after he heard some noise. He found the boys hiding under a blueberry bush about 90 minutes into the search and called 911 after hearing one of the boys say, "They found us." Police Lieutenant Keith Robb said the boys didn't want to go to school today. Prisoner uses bed sheets and escape. Falls when knot slips. This is out of Louisville, Kentucky. Two inmates at Louisville, Kentucky jail could have used a course in knot tying when authorities say they plotted and escaped using bed sheets. Officials say the men escaped to the roof of a minimum security building Monday night and used a rope made of bedsheets to climb down about four floors. Metro Corrections Director Mark Bolton says 29-year-old Matthew Johnson was climbing down when a knot on the sheets came loose, dropping him about 20 feet. He then fled. Police learned of the escape around 9 p.m. when a hospital worker saw Johnson climbing down. The second inmate, 37-year-old Christopher Cornelius, didn't risk the climb and was found on the roof. Bolton said Johnson was found hiding in a car during a traffic stop early Tuesday morning. He'd injured his ankle and back and remained hospitalized Tuesday. Both men were in jail on drug charges. Man charged with punching 78-year-old over waffle sample. Burbank, California. A 24-year-old man has been charged with elder abuse after authorities said he punched a 78-year-old man over free Nutella waffle samples at a Los Angeles area Costco store. Prosecutor said Derek Garabigi of Burbank was charged Tuesday. He pleaded not guilty in an afternoon court appearance. He is being held on $50,000 bail, and he faces a maximum sentence of 11 years in prison if convicted. The Los Angeles District Attorney's Office said he was hoarding samples of the waffles at the Burbank Costco on Sunday morning when a 78-year-old told him to take just one. Prosecutors said Garabigi then punched the older man in the face. Police said the senior citizen was hospitalized with a 1-inch cut and swelling above his eyes. Cops. Chocolate factory worker makes bomb threat to be fired. St. Albans, Vermont. Police say a Vermont chocolate factory worker hated his job and wanted to get fired, so he did the first thing that came to mind. He called in a bomb threat. Police said 22-year-old Christopher Prigent stole a co-worker's cell phone and made the false threat under a different worker's name Monday night at the Barry Colabot chocolate factory in St. Albans. Police said Prigent then threw the cell phone in a toilet tank. He first told police he received a bomb threat, then he later said it didn't happen. He told officers he was unhappy with his job and wanted out. Prigent was charged with false public alarm, petty larceny, and unlawful mischief. A phone number for him couldn't be found on Tuesday. $1 million lottery ticket found in among woman's mail. Kentwood, Michigan. A Michigan woman who won a $1 million lottery prize didn't know about it for months after leaving the ticket in a pile of mail. Lottery officials said Linda Tuttle of Kentwood stepped forward Tuesday with a winning ticket from the May 26 Mega Millions drawing. Tuttle told officials she recently found the ticket at home among small mail. She didn't search until a clerk at the local store mentioned that it had been sold at a local store had sold a $1 million winner in May. Tuttle plans to use some money to visit former exchange students in China. I'm going to go visit some former exchange students. PETA sues to give monkey the copyright of selfie photos. A macaque monkey who is took famous now famous selfie photographs should be declared the copyright owner of the photos rather than the nature photographer who positioned the camera, animal rights activists contend in a novel lawsuit filed Tuesday. End of the weird news, I believe. We'll finish the last 8 minutes of part two here from Decatur with reading from other papers. This is ruby-throated hummingbirds heading south. Incredible journey for tiny jewels of the air. This is by Robert Themer for the Daily Journal. A quote from John James Audubon, who lived from 1785 to 1851. No sooner has the returning sun again introduced the vernal season and caused millions of plants to expand their leaves and blossoms to his genial beams than the little hummingbird is seen advancing on fairy wings, carefully visiting every opening flower cup and, like a curious florist, removing from each of the injurious insects that otherwise would air long because their beauteous petals to droop and decay. Remarkably, as Audubon observed, their return in spring, the tiny ruby-throated hummingbirds would have recently made their incredible migration from Central America. After wintering in between southern Mexico and northern Panama, most of these tiny jewels will have made the incredible feat of flying nonstop across 500 miles of Gulf of Mexico, according to the website hummingbirds.net. Some skirt along the Texas coast and others hop from island to island, the most apparently leaving their southern homes at dusk for 18 to 22 hours of nonstop flight across the Gulf. Think of millions of wingbeats. They leave weighing 3.25 to 6 grams, 0.22 ounce for the heavyweights, and arrive dwindled to 2.5 grams. Only a few of the 300 hummingbird species worldwide migrate. But most of the North American species do travel to breed in northern spring and summer and winter in their summer grounds. The ruby-throated is the only hummingbird that breeds in the spring in eastern North America and returns to its southern grounds for winter, according to Cornell Lab of Ornithology. If they haven't left the South already, they will be departing soon. They'll be departing soon, and many of them will make that nonstop flight across the Gulf. They fly straight and fast, but can stop instantly, hover, and adjust their position up, down, or backwards with exquisite control, Cornell Lab says. They often visit hummingbird feeders and tube-shaped flowers and defend the food sources against others. You may also see them plucking tiny insects from the air or from spider webs. Their habits become familiar to backyard birders, including that they can be very predictable with their migration patterns, Cornell says. Notes: individual birds often migrate at the same time each year, each arriving and leaving the same yards within just a day or two. You probably come to the same conclusion that I have, and that is that the person who wrote the headline got it just wrong. It's ruby-throated hummingbirds heading north, not heading south. But that's interesting anyway. And we now know at some point they're going to head south. Next article. Health. Time for flu vaccine updated after misery of last winter. This is by Lauren Neergard for the Associated Press. Washington. It's time for the flu shots again, and health officials expect to avoid a repeat of the misery last winter when immunizations weren't a good match for a nasty surprise strain. More than 170 million doses of flu vaccine are expected this year, with options ranging from traditional shots, a nasal spray, a high-dose version for seniors, and even a needle-free injection for the squeamish. Getting the flu vaccine is the best way to protect yourself against the flu, Dr. Tom Frieden, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said Thursday. Last year's flu season was especially rough as the harsh new type A strain burst on the scene after vaccine doses already were brewed, leaving them less effective than usual. Flu-related hospitalizations of the seniors were the highest recorded in the decade the CDC has counted. This year's vaccine contains protection against that bug and other strains that specialists consider most likely to spread. So far, the strains in this year's vaccine seem likely to match, Frieden said. Still, flu viruses are tricky, and there's no guarantee another surprise won't crop up. Fewer than half of Americans get an annual flu immunization, even though the CDC says on average flu kills about 24,000 people per year in the U.S. New CDC data shows vaccination rates last year were highest for children aged 6 months to 23 months at 75%, the only age group to meet public health goals. Not far behind were adults older than 65 and children aged 2 to 4. About two-thirds of each group got vaccinated. Least likely to be vaccinated were adults aged 18 to 49. Even the healthy, whether kids or adults, can benefit from flu vaccine, not only to ward off their own illness, but also to keep from spreading it to others, the CDC said. And then in kind of a sidebar here, researchers work on flu shot to cover all strains. Two groups of American researchers recently announced progress in their efforts to create a single flu vaccine. The goal is to find a universal vaccine that will offer broader coverage against all types of influenza each season. It's possible such a vaccine would even provide long-term protection, preparing our immune system to fight off the flu for many seasons. The challenge in developing such a vaccine has been the flu virus's ability to mutate quickly. Even slight changes to a virus may interfere with our body's ability to control it before it makes us sick. This newly reported single vaccine research focuses on a protein called hemagglutinin, which all influenza virus strains have in common. It's hemagglutinin, hemagglutinin, which all influenza virus strains have in common. End of that article. And concluding part two, Wednesday, September 23rd, 2015, reading of Decatur paper plus a couple extra things, is an article by Rob Cantor, Environmental Almanac, titled Just One Part of a Big Plan. Since there's only a minute left here, this will be condensed. If you've been keeping up with the news, says Rob Cantor, from the University of Illinois this summer, you already know that one of the most interesting developments on campus is the solar farm currently being installed near the intersection of Windsor Road and First Street on the South Farms. On the chance you've been distracted by other news, here's the short version. The project is being implemented by a company called Phoenix Solar and made possible in part by a significant financial contribution from the Student Sustainable Committee. When complete, it will cover 21 acres and produce 7.86 million kilowatt hours per year, or about 2% of the campus's current annual demand. 2%! You may see that figure and wonder, why bother? The solar farm might be limited interest were it a standalone project, but it's not. It's one project among many that, together, are intended to make the campus carbon neutral by the year 2050. That's a goal we adopted when we signed on the American College and University Presidents Climate Committee in 2008. To date, our progress toward carbon neutrality has been guided by the Illinois Climate Action Plan, ICAP, which was adopted in 2010. How should we characterize our progress? One way McCall suggested approaching this question was when we spoke last year was to look at how much we've reduced our net carbon emissions. He estimated that to be 15% between fiscal years 2008 and 2014. Coming up, First Presbyterian Church of Urbana is sponsoring a public seminar called Confronting Climate Change. The series takes place on six straight Sundays beginning October 4th. End of what we're going to read by Rob Cantor, and end of section two. Talk to you again next week.